This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Pop and dance music from around the world have started to catch on in America. Now we call it world music. But it wasn't too long ago that the only people interested in music from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and India were ethnomusicologists. My guest, John Storm Roberts, was one of the exceptions. He's been listening to music of other cultures most of his life, and he's been bringing music from around the world to Americans since the early 70s. That's Ghana High Life music from Robert's 1973 record, Africa Dances, one of the seminal records of what's come to be called Afropop. Several of Robert's early records have recently been reissued on CD by his company Original Music. Original Music is both a record label and a distribution company with a varied catalog of world music records, videos, and books. Roberts is also the author of the books Black Music of Two Worlds and The Latin Tinge. No one was using the expression world music when Roberts started listening as a teenager in England. He told me it was his parents who first got him listening.
There was a flamenco fad in England in the 30s. Calypso they knew from the 30s. Jazz and blues for rather personal reasons. My father, even at Cambridge in the 20s, had a friend who imported American blues records. So there were people who were interested. It's just nobody had thought of a label to stick on it. When I started, there wasn't any such animal. I mean, as a kid, we were buying anything we could find, and if it had an alphabet we couldn't even identify, we bought the record instantly. But, you know, it was Arabic music or this or that or the other. There wasn't a label to cover the whole thing.
It seems to me the attitude about certain international music has changed completely. It used to be people wanted to protect the purity of music. They were unhappy when there were Western influences on African music. And now there's a celebration of this cross-fertilization. What do you think of the change in attitude?
It's more realistic. I mean, basically, it wasn't that people objected to influences on African music. They objected to any influence that had happened in the last 50 years, or more precisely, any influence that had happened since they started looking.
Right.
You know, it's like everybody over a certain age hates the music that displaced the music that they loved when they were young. I mean, it's nonsense. One of the most major influences on African music is the Islamic influence over 1,000 years and still creeping across Africa. And do you hear people denouncing the rotten Islamification of African music? No. You know, it's also, you have to remember that things start in a rather weird way. I mean, very early Congolese recordings were actually very bad attempts to imitate Cuban music. And these attempts to imitate Cuban music led to a splendid, major, very influential new style. If they'd all been able to play Cuban music, of course, it might never have happened. So in other words, the process, a very good process, can come out of things that look as if they're not a good thing at the beginning.
Since you mentioned the influence of Cuban music on African music, why don't we hear something that I think is a good example of that? And this is from the first album that you produced. The album is called Africa Dances. And this is a piece that was recorded in Zaire. You describe it as African jazz. Do you want to say anything about it? I think it certainly shows the influence of Cuban music.
Yeah, it's probably what people who are involved in African music now will know as soukous, except that soukous was a rhythm that came along later. It's kind of pre-soukous Congolese music. It was, I may say, this cut enormously influential. I mean, I remember a nightclub in Nairobi, when this would start up, the band, resident band, would start playing this at 4 a.m, and everybody would start chanting, and you felt that the whole place was going to kind of lift up into the dawn like some kind of spaceship.
What year was this recorded in?
I'm not sure. I heard it. It was a big hit in 1963, so I would say 62, 63.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
Some music from the album Africa Dances, which is some early examples of world music, an album produced by my guest John Storm Roberts. Can you explain why there was such a strong Cuban influence on certain parts of African music?
Fundamentally, no. But practically speaking, yes. The way it worked was that sometime in the 30s, CBS masters of Cuban groups of the septeto style, the groups that had basically guitars and maybe one trumpet playing in a very kind of wrought iron sort of way, were brought into England, and the masters were sent over and they were pressed and they were sold throughout Africa. It was an enormous influence. I mean, Francis Bebe, who is a major musicologist and musician from Cameroon, and a friend of mine, was telling me about the famous GV series, which was the prefix of these records. And then Okot Bitek, who is a Ugandan playwright I met once, was going on about them too. So in other words, they were sold right across the continent. Why it was so powerful, I think, is because Cuban music has very strong African influences. But at the same time, you have to remember, any particular African music is, or anyway used to be, pretty local, whereas the Cuban stuff was kind of generalized, so that it sounded familiar to people in both East Africa and West Africa, and at the same time didn't sound like somebody else's music. I mean, it was a kind of a generalized African sound.
Let's talk about when you lived in Kenya. I'm sure that that was a kind of critical experience for you and your interest in world music.
Yeah. What it was when I started giving back what I was learning. I mean, I really started getting involved in listening to music from all over the world when in my teens in London. I mean, I bought an Umm Kulthum record, and it took me 2 years to discover that she was the greatest of Egyptian singers of the 20th century. You know, that kind of thing. We were really buying everything. But it was in Kenya that I started writing about it.
You went to Kenya to write for the East African Standard
of Nairobi? I went to Kenya as what's known in England as a sub-editor. I'm the person who puts the headlines on the reporter's stuff and, depending on whom you believe, make it literate or ruin it. You know?
Right.
And I went there just 3 weeks before independence, and discovered there was all this music being played on the Swahili language service of the radio that nobody could tell me about, including my African friends, who were all kind of upwardly mobile and, you know, the new professional class and things. And this was Swahili language guitar music, and they didn't want to know about it. They were more interested in the Congolese stuff. And so I started finding out and began by writing an article, front page feature section of the East African Standards, photographs taken by me, translations, transliterations, interviews, you name it. I think, and I was paid $12.50 for that. So that was the beginning of my career as a professional writer about African music.
What were the American and European hits that were being played in Africa during the years that you lived there?
I don't remember, because I didn't listen to them. I mean, we're talking 63, 64, so obviously the Beatles were big, the Rolling Stones, people like that. I tell you, somebody who was enormously popular in Kenya, of course, was Jim Reeves. I say, of course, sorry. Somebody who was enormously popular in Kenya was Jim Reeves, the country singer. I mean, I once read one of those weird trivia statistics whereby outside the U.S., Norway had the biggest sales of Jim Reeves in a particular year, and Kenya had the second biggest.
I guess what I find interesting about the influence of country music in Africa is that in America, a lot of country music was considered fairly anti-black in a way, you know, very just very separatist music. And you don't think of it as having a strong influence on African-American music.
It does, though. I mean, there's quite a black audience for country music, and always was. I mean, the fact that many of the people playing it had undesirable attitudes was a different matter. I mean, one of the best-kept secrets, I've only seen it in one book, was that Elvis Presley's first really enthusiastic public was black teenagers on Beale Street. Now, you know, the whites don't want to admit to that. On his anniversary, nobody brought that up, but it was true. And in Africa, I think the thing is country music's relatively simple. We're talking about certain sorts of country music. An enormously popular artist was Jimmy Rogers of the 1930s. Jimmy Rogers was also the man who made what was then hillbilly music into a style that was nationally popular in the States, because it was clean, it was simple, it was easily graspable, and it was attractive. And that you could say the same things about Jim Reeves. I mean, the real nasal kind of back in the hollers kind of field recordings wouldn't go anywhere in Africa.
Well, you actually have a record that shows a really strong Jimmy Rogers influence. Well, this is particularly true in the guitar playing on the record. This is from another album that you produced called African Acoustic Music from the Copper Belt. And you want to listen to that? Is there anything you could tell us about this performance?
Only that the Jimmy Rogers runs in the guitar are by no means unique. I've got a tape of a South African 78 with the same things. I've heard Congolese musicians who do a wonderful mix of runs. You know, you'll get one real Cuban run next to a Jimmy Rogers run. The country music, the influence of American U.S. country music in Africa was ongoing and enormous from the 30s throughout, and nobody's really noticed it because all the references are kind of scattered, you know, passing comments by people. It's the sort of thing that ethnomusicologists didn't approve of, and so they didn't take much notice of it.
Right. This is also from the 1960s, yes?
This was recorded in 1950, I think, 7, by Hugh Tracy, who founded the International Library of African Music. It was recorded in the mine compounds of Zambia and was really an area which was very closely linked with Zaire, with the pre-Sukus music. I mean, the mines in Zambia just across the border from the mines in what was Katanga and is now Shaba. So it's really all one style.
Let's give it a listen.
Wea fya shchengeleni pantu mukafyala bana tamwakabalire pona ngulimo iyo. Abana ndi wafyala abana basuma na fyale tiwele wele tabana. Abana ndi wafyala abana basuma na fyale tiwele wele tabana. Na fyale tiwele wele na fyale tiwele wele na fyale tiwele wele tabana. Na fyale tiwele wele.
The performers are Kabushi and Mwenya. You were telling us that you got to Kenya about 3 weeks before it got its independence. It really makes me think about how much all the cross-influence had to do with colonization, don't you think?
Some of it, yeah. I mean, really, the reality is that this whole concept, as far as I'm concerned, of national musics in pure form is just a fantasy. I mean, there may be three characters sitting in the middle of the bleakest desert in Australasia performing something that had no influence from anywhere else. But I don't believe it. Australian Aboriginal music was influenced from Polynesia. Africa was always permeable borders. I mean, the fact that 19th century Europeans showed up and didn't notice anything much and thought that it was, you know, this kind of, in this primitive, pristine state was just plain old Victorian ignorance. And everything is the result of something else and the result of blendings of other things, some of them local, some of them not. And that's true anywhere you go. So, yes, colonization, they were colonies. Music happened in those colonies. I think it may be interesting that actually a lot of this music developed towards the end of the colonial period and the beginning of the independence period, but I wouldn't even make too much of that because I think there's all sorts of things to do with communications. Just a lot of different elements. Certainly, I think that the end of the colonial period began a period where you didn't need to play waltzes to please the paying customers. But, I mean, there are a lot of things one can postulate in terms of musical politics, but, you know, basically they're all just interpretations. But essentially all music comes from other music, some of it local, and usually with a catalyst from somewhere else. And all music is going somewhere else.
Do you think that there's an element of fad and commercialization that's going along with the new popularity of world music?
Oh, undoubtedly, sure. And I mean, there are slogans that I don't intend to get into, which are just regarded as jokes that some companies use that they appear to be serious about. But the thing is, there's always fad and fancy, and there's always this thing of novelty hits. One of the favorite things of the record industry is falling into the novelty hit catch again, where something hits because it's a novelty, so they try and do it again and lose a lot of money. But the real thing goes on, and serious stuff goes. I'm a great believer in Pareto's law, you know, basically the theory that 80% of anything is eh, and 20% of it is more than eh. And that applies to any sort of music, and that applies to anything that's going on now, including the crossover stuff. I think the difference is you get a lot of... There's a guy called Ismaël Lô, who's a Senegalese, and the Senegalese, real interesting stuff. They're full of funk, they're full of electronics, they're full of, hey, hey, what's happening, man, you know? And some of them, like the... some of the recordings, like some of the later Youssou N'Dour recordings, are dismal if you know the originals that he was doing for the Senegalese. They're not dismal if you don't, because they're a change, at least. But if you know the real thing, they're dismal. Because some French producer or somebody decided they could make him into an international star, God save the mark, which they won't, any more than they did with Sunny Ade or anybody else. You know, they're just wasting everybody's time, not that it matters. But then you get people like Ismaël Lô, who has everything in there except the kitchen sink because he likes it. And the end result is different.
Is there a lot of competition now between American companies and African companies for who's going to sign and distribute the more popular Afropop performers?
Absolutely doesn't work like that. Firstly, America is a very bad market for Afropop. America is not interested in large terms. I mean, England, though a much smaller country, is much more interested. The last CD we put out, our major American producer ordered 1/5 the quantity that the Japanese ordered from us. I've been a journalist for 35 years, or I was a journalist for 35 years. Journalists, particularly those who are enthusiastic about things, need new things to write about. They're interested in what's new. These kind of music tend to get written about, and it's not invalid. It's just that basically what sells records is not a small group of real enthusiasts. I mean, how many can they buy each? What's important is millions of people who may not be that interested, but are just interested enough to go in and lay down $10. I mean, commercially, that's what's important. But what happens as far as the American companies are concerned is that we license stuff. We license it either from Europe or Africa. So basically the record's first put out in Europe or first put out in Africa, and then it's licensed for production and distribution here. There are exceptions, but there is not competition. Paris and, to a lesser extent, London are the non-African centers.
How did you get into the business of world music?
Basically, I had Africa dancers sitting around in the cellar, and we were thinking of moving, and we put together a one-page flyer to try and get rid of what we had left. I mean, I put that record out, and I hadn't the faintest idea what I was doing. I mean, I think we sold 200 copies in the first 5 years. This was before I started original music. And it occurred to me, obviously, the way to make this stuff available, if I want to sound less commercial about it, is mail order. I mean, we're talking, when I put out Africa Dances, the idea was that virtually nobody knew that African music existed other than Ola Tunji and, you know, the occasional drum. And the idea of Africa Dance is to show the enormous variety of music there was. And I still like people music. I mean, the common thread, apart from the fact that we never put out anything that's going to be expensive because we don't have any money, so you can't expect any big stars on original music, is that I'm involved in what I call street music, which is the music that falls between what the ethnomusicologists are interested in and what the local commercial record companies regard as hip, which is basically three-quarters of the world's music. So that's what we do.
So these are people who aren't necessarily recording professionally?
Some of them are, some of them aren't. Many of them aren't. And I mean, basically, if one's honest about it, all these things are a matter partially of personal taste, partially of opportunity and availability and just the capacity to do it. I mean, I couldn't put out a Sunny Ade record to save my life because I couldn't afford the advance.
Yeah. Let me play something that the compact disc version of Africa Dances closes out with. And this is something called Love is Love. It's Ethiopian, but it has an incredible Arabic and soul music influence on it. What can you tell us about this? And is this an example of the kind of street music that you're talking about?
Yeah, actually it was recorded in some nightclub by a buddy of mine way, way back. But actually Ethiopian music, there's a group called Mahmoud Ahmed, a record that has just been reissued on CD, which is incredibly electronic. They tend to be heavily into the electronics. And it's kind of difficult. I want to get hold of the Ethiopian street music, but it's just not something I've been able to do. But this particular piece you're going to play is a lovely example of music at a stage before it's all shaken down into a new style, because you have the very Cushitic singing style, the very Ethiopian singing style, and then this rather lumpy soul background.
What do you think this evolved into?
Well, it evolved into the kind of somewhat funk-oriented but very Ethiopian, very electronic music of people like Mahmoud Ahmed and a whole bunch of others that's going on at the moment.
Well, before we hear it, let me thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
And my guest has been John Storm Roberts, and he is the founder of Original Music, which is a company that produces and distributes world music. And he's also the author of the books Black Music of Two Worlds and The Latin Tinge. Most of the music, including the track we're about to hear, is featured on an album he produced back in the early 70s, and the album is called Africa Dances.
ጀመሩት ፍቅር ፍቅር ነው ምንድነው ፈገግታ እንዳለ ጊዜው ከአንጀት ከጀመሩት ፍቅር ፍቅር ነው ከአንገት በላይ ስቆ